Welcome back again to BadQuicker.com. This is podcast number 40. I'm Ben Stone. Today is Tuesday, October 25th, 2011. This is probably going to be a brief podcast, although, you know, I said that last week. I think it was like Friday or something, and it turned out to be like a 50-minute rant, so who knows. It looks like Rick Perry, this was one of the headlines this morning, Rick Perry proposes a 20% flat tax. He would keep popular deductions for mortgage interest and charitable gifts. Well, that was just a matter of time. Whether it came from Rick Perry or not is not really the point. Once again, we have Republicans teasing America with the hopes of lowering their taxes. Currently, at least two Republicans that I know of are teasing a flat tax right now. At this point, I wish I was good at video making. I wish I was like one of these people who's really good with YouTube and really good at making videos. Because what I would do is I would search the internet and go back to the 70s and find clips of Republicans promising the flat tax. It's really almost, if you can take your mind out of being here watching this stuff as one of us and make yourself a casual observer, watching Republican politicians tease the electorate with the flat tax could almost be a career in itself. Just every time when a Republican politician is desperate, they start dangling this flat tax out there. And this has a great appeal to Republicans within a very specific sector. Middle income, mainstream Republicans look at the flat tax and they see that as a in their minds a very fair way to deal with the taxation problem. So when a Republican candidate and this will work on pretty much any level, senatorial, congressional, local levels, Republican candidates, that is, know that if they roll out this teaser, this flat tax, there will be a large group of middle-income mainstream Republicans that will just line up for this because it sounds so good. But as soon as the election is over, you know, I just thought about a flower, the morning glory. One year, we have a garden here. We have a fairly aggressive garden. Is that a good way to put it? We have a lot of things that are perennials that grow every year, like our grapes and our raspberry bushes and our asparagus. And, I can't even think. I didn't plan on talking about that, so I haven't even thought about the garden. And then we also grow the typical stuff, the tomatoes and the peppers and green beans and all this kind of stuff. One year, we planted morning glories because they're a pretty plant. And morning glories, you plant them early in the spring, just when the threat of frost is gone. And they grow and they grow and they grow and they grow and they don't produce anything. And you keep thinking, these morning glories are climbing all over the fence. They're going everywhere. And they're not producing anything. And then all of a sudden, at some point, one morning you get up, and they're just covered in flowers. And they're beautiful. These flowers are beautiful. But then as soon as the light of the hard part of the daytime sun hits these morning glories, they just disappear. They just roll up and hide. And that's the way they finish their day. Now, the Republicans, politicians, and their flat tax are much like morning glories. They grow and they grow and they grow and they grow and they never produce anything. And then when they finally do start to produce something, as soon as the light of the day hits it, it disappears. Now, that's the case with the flat tax. I'm old. I'm 50 years old. And all my adult memory, Republican candidates have been teasing the electorate with their flat tax, and there is no flat tax. And there's a reason why there is no flat tax. I'll get to that in just a second. First, I want to say, what is so appealing about a flat tax? Well, the flat tax is not appealing to everyone. Specifically, the flat tax is not appealing to people in lower income. And the reason why is because people in lower income don't pay any income tax currently. They haven't for a long time. And the group on the bottom that doesn't pay income tax is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So a flat tax has absolutely no appeal to them because they're not paying any income tax now anyway. So they don't want to voluntarily just jump out there and say, yeah, I want to pay a flat tax. They're paying no income tax. As a matter of fact, according to which year it is and according to what games Washington is playing, there are lower income people in the United States who pay zero income tax and still get a refund when tax time rolls around. Now think about that for a minute. They don't pay any income tax in, and they still get a refund when income tax time rolls around. That's a concept that when middle-income Republicans think about that, it makes their head hurt. So none of those people are going to go for a flat tax. Now, I said a second ago that that group is growing. They're growing dramatically since 2008. And the Democratic Party depends on those people as solid foundational Democratic voters. So when it gets to a general election time, you'll see this flat tax just fall away from the conversation because the Republicans can't get elected only using their middle-income mainstream Republicans. They can't get elected on a national level using just those voters. When the national election comes around, they have to quiet down the talk of the flat tax, and they have to appeal to those lower income voters. And the other group that I haven't mentioned yet that gets hit really hard with a flat tax is the higher income folks. Now here's the funny part. Republicans will tell you all day, let me back up. The Democrats use this as a hammer to beat Republicans with. They say the Republicans want to give the rich a tax break. The Republicans want to give the rich a tax break. Well, the flat tax is the opposite of a tax break for the rich. The flat tax would slap massive amounts of tax on the rich because the rich have a multitude of ways that they avoid income tax just like the poor do. That's not to say that the rich don't pay income tax. The rich do pay income tax. But in proportion, look at it this way. I did a thing that was about money production. Let me see if I can find the title of that really quick here. I did an article titled "Fiat Money is Not Out of Thin Air." And one of the examples I gave in that article, to try to set the difference in how different people value money, I used Bill Gates as an example, and I said Bill Gates is walking in front of a coffee shop, and he's holding a $5 bill in his hand. Now, the $5 bill to Bill Gates has a specific value, and he is willing to walk into this coffee shop, or have his people walk into the coffee shop, and he's more than willing to hand them that $5 bill in exchange for a cup of coffee. The people in the coffee shop, on the other hand, would prefer to have his $5 bill rather than a cup of coffee. Otherwise, that exchange couldn't take place. So Bill Gates values a cup of coffee greater than a $5 bill. But the people in the coffee shop value the $5 bill greater than the cup of coffee. And then we bring in a third party. Let's say we have a disabled person who's walking by on the street and is on a limited income. There's no possible way he would trade $5 for a stinking cup of coffee. It doesn't matter if there's a picture of a goddess on the cup or whatever. He's not going to pay $5 for a cup of coffee. So here you have three different people with three different values for the same actual quantity of money. Now, that's the case throughout all levels and throughout any situation with money. If we all valued money exactly the same, there would be no exchange. We have to have a variation of how we view the money in order for there to be an exchange. So then, people in the upper income levels, if you do the hard numbers, they pay almost all the taxes now. The difference is, when Bill Gates pays his taxes, he has levels and levels and levels and levels of deductions so that those taxes don't sting. Because let me promise you something. If the really rich, if they paid enough taxes that it hurt, things would change really fast in the tax structure. The middle class Americans feel like they pay taxes at every turn. It feels like they're paying taxes constantly. That's because they are. We're paying, according to who's doing the numbers, if you go with numbers coming from the Heritage Foundation or from the Cato Institute or from, according to where you get your numbers, from the right, from the left, from libertarians, middle income Americans are paying somewhere between half and about 60 to 65% of their income overall goes to taxes in some form or another. Now, that's not all just income tax. There are layers of tax hidden within things that we never think about, we never see. There are things that you purchase that have been taxed over and over and over and over before you ever put your hands on them. And this is how the tax structure does. They hide these taxes in so many layers that you never see where all the taxes are coming from. If we just had to write a check once a year for the amount of tax, at least it would be honest. But right now, the tax is slid into so many different places that it's impossible to find all of the ways that we pay taxes. Well, that hits the middle income bracket in a more obvious way than other groups, because they're in a position where money is tight for them, and they're watching where the money goes. Their income is far more limited than the upper income levels. And so they see this, and they also see two other things. Middle income people know that the rich are not proportionately paying the same amount of tax as the middle income. Now, I just said a second ago, the rich pay most of the income tax. They do. But remember the value that I was talking about there with Bill Gates. Bill Gates can throw down a $5 bill for that cup of coffee with no problem. And the reason he can is because the money has a different value to him. If you taxed the rich to the same value that you tax the middle income, well, the rich wouldn't tolerate that. We'd have a new government. That's how fast that would happen. Now you think about the flat tax. If you're all of a sudden going to tax the rich, which is really what the flat tax is about, if you're all of a sudden going to jump in there and tax the rich, Rick Perry is one of the people proposing a flat tax, and he says 20%. If you're going to go to Warren Buffett and hit him with a flat 20% tax, things are going to change in government real fast, because that's just not going to happen. So really, the appeal of the flat tax is the same. It's exactly the same as the Democrats use in the general election to appeal to voters to say the rich are not paying their fair share. We need to hit the rich much harder. But the Republicans are slick. They're smart. Well, in ways they're smart. They know that by presenting the flat tax, they can quietly, without saying it, present something to middle-income Republican voters that says, again without saying it, it says, we're going to hit the rich hard for taxes. We're going to lighten your load, and we're going to hit the rich. And you know who else we're going to hit? Those poor people that don't pay any income tax at all, we're going to make them pay their fair share too. Now, the Republicans are not going to say that out in the open. But underneath, That's the message. That's the message to the mainstream middle-income Republicans. The flat tax is going to level it, level playing field. They like to say level playing field. They like to say that it's fair. Someone call it the fair tax, because no matter what your income, if you're way up there in the millions or if you're down here in 20,000, you're going to pay a flat 20%. But is that fair? Let's think of a different scenario. Let's say you're riding in a 1800s coach, and you're riding across the countryside being pulled by horses, and you're in this coach with several other people. And let's say a highwayman stops the coach, and he's got his pistols out. And the old phrase from the olden days is stand and deliver. So the highwayman stops the coach, and the coach driver is given the orders to stand up and throw out the strongbox. So he does that. And then the highwayman opens the coach door and says, everybody out. So all the occupants, all the coach riders, they all climb out of the coach. And this is like, we can imagine this according to where you're at and what your background and your culture is. We can imagine this as the typical English coach with the typical English riders of the 1800s and the typical English highwayman. Or we can think of the Wild Wild West, and we can think of a stagecoach and the people getting out of it. It's like some scene out of a Hollywood movie from the 50s or something with all your typical characters that you would see in a Western. And they all climb out of the stagecoach, and there's the robber with his pistols, and he starts looking them all over, and then he does an odd thing. He starts asking them to fill out a form for him showing how much income that they have and what their property is worth and where their income comes from. Who pays you this income? What do you do for this income? And what was your income like last year? Have you had an increase or a decrease in your income? And how many children do you have? And do you own a home? Do you give to charity? Now, can you imagine a robber actually doing this? Can you imagine a highwayman stopping a coach and getting everybody out of the coach and have them start to fill out forms indicating their income level, where they get their income from, what kind of charities they donate to, what kind of possessions they own? Do you own a home? Do you pay interest on that home? Can you imagine a highwayman, a robber, asking these questions to the occupants of a coach? Of course not. That's ridiculous. Why would he do that? He just robs. No bank robber goes into a bank, robs the bank, and then starts robbing the individual customers of the bank according to their income level. Robbers don't do that. That would be silly. Actually, robbers are generally more honest than that. Robbers don't attempt to fool you by having you fill out forms. They just stick a gun in your face and say, give me, and they take whatever they can take, and they leave. But you see, the state is not like that. The state is subtle. The state has you fill out forms and get you all involved and lets you vote and talks about this kind of tax and that kind of tax. Maybe we need 9% income tax and 9% sales tax and 9% flat tax and 9%. You know, I'm jumping off the topic here for a second. But that's Herman Cain's thing, this 999 thing. It's funny because it wasn't that long ago that Herman Cain was saying that to introduce a national sales tax would just be an excuse to get a European-style taxation into the U.S., and he said it was a bad idea. Now all of a sudden it's a good idea because he's running for an election, and he can use that as a device, as a talking point, this 999 thing. And people make, they make a joke out of it. 999, I thought that was the price of a pizza. Ha, 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 ha. Every hack comedian in the United States is using that line right now. Here's the problem. Cain's little job at the pizza place was a minor footnote in his history. Look up Herman Cain in Wikipedia. Do you know that he used to work for the Federal Reserve? Do you know that he was chairman? Do you know these things about him? Do you know that being a CEO of a massive corporation is not being a businessman? Do you understand that? Don't be conned by these titles and this, oh, he's a regular guy, he used to work in a pizza place. And then there's these pictures of him in a pizza place. Come on. Are we that easy to be conned? Is that all it takes for the Republicans to wheel out somebody like this and we all get behind him? Anyway, I wasn't going to do that, but I did that anyway, so there it is. So let's get back to the highwaymen. Is it somehow fair to rob people using trickery in different proportions and have them decide, well, we're going to take this from you, and we're going to take this from you, and we're going to take this from you, and rob everyone to the level that they don't mind? Does that become acceptable? What if we rob the middle class? If the middle class is comfortable with a 20% income tax, then why don't we have a 20% income tax on the middle class? And then a different proportion for the rich and a different proportion for the poor. Because after all, it doesn't really matter how much you're being robbed, and it doesn't really matter how much somebody else is being robbed. What really matters is that the robbery is taking place. You see, if you were in that coach and the highwayman pulled you out of the coach and lined everybody up and demanded that you show your pockets, and you reach into your pockets and you give what you have, and you notice that the person next to you is hiding a ring on their finger, and the highwayman doesn't see that they're hiding that ring, would you bust them on that? Would you say, hey, look at this guy's ring? Would you do that? Is that the kind of a thing that would be a good thing to do? Hey, look, that guy over there, I think he's got an expensive watch. Would that be an honest thing to do? Would that be a moral thing to do? Would it be moral to point out, like, let's go back, you're in the coach, you're riding along across the countryside, you're in the coach, and there's chatter among the coach riders, and one of the coach riders says, you know, we're coming up on a dangerous pass up ahead. I think I'm going to take my change purse, and I'm going to slide that into my boot. That way, if we get robbed, I'll still have my change purse. And everybody chuckles, oh, what a good idea. But nobody else does it. Only the one guy takes his little purse of change and puts it into his boot. Then the highwayman stops the coach, pulls everybody out, starts robbing everybody, doesn't know about the guy's change purse in his boot. Are you going to bust him out? Are you going to say, hey, what about that guy? Check his boot. He's got money in his boot. Would you do that? Would you help the robber that way? Of course not, because it's not your business to make sure the robber gets more money from the guy who hid the money in his boot. You see, it's all about jealousy. The only reason you would bust that guy out like that and rat him out to the robber is if you're jealous that he got away with something that you didn't get away with. That's not a good trait. If the rich can get away with not paying taxes, good for them. If the poor can get away with not paying taxes, good for them. The middle class, the middle income people need to get away with not paying taxes because it's robbery. The issue is not how much you're paying. The issue is that there's a gun shoved in your face. You've chosen not to look at it. You've chosen to pretend there's not a gun. But there's a gun, and it's pointed right square at your forehead. And if you don't pay your taxes, off you go. And if you resist, bang. Now that's the hard facts. Taxation is robbery. The question of how much robbery are you willing to tolerate before you fight back is the great balance that the politicians play constantly. Right now, for all those people marching in all the different cities to occupy this and occupy that, for them, the point has come to the level of where many of them are college students dealing with college debt, and they're getting to the point of where the taxation which is actually the debt that's being laid upon them that they've been conned into accepting. That debt is actually taxation, because think about where it goes to. Think about where all that college loans and all that college money goes to. You think in your mind, the government? No, come on. Whether the money comes out of your pocket and goes into the pockets of the big bankers, or whether it goes into the pockets of the actual federal tax services, or whether it goes out of your pockets into any of these tentacles of the state, it's the whole point in robbing you is not to get your money. The point in robbing you is to keep you as the victim and to keep you as the slave, to keep you working constantly and never picking your head up and seeing what you are and why you're doing what you're doing. That's the whole point. You know, here's the facts, and several people have pointed this out over the years. If you take all of the income that the Internal Revenue Service in the United States produces, all the money they rob from people, and then if you take all the money that the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, uses to steal that money, and you balance those books, what you have is a drop in the bucket of the total budget. In other words, you could eliminate all income tax tomorrow, and the government would continue to function as it functions, because the little amount that's brought into the government through income tax is nothing compared to all the rest of the funding that the government has. The whole purpose of the income tax is not to get money out of your pocket. It's to maintain your position as a slave, to keep your head down, to keep your head bowed, and to keep your shoulder at the wheel, constantly pushing, constantly trying to make your way. That's the whole purpose of the income tax. And when it comes to young people and college graduates that are burdened with this massive tax, that is all the debt that they've been conned into accepting, the purpose of that is to simply beat them down and keep their heads down and keep their shoulder to the wheel. That's what it's about. It's not about the actual money, because the state doesn't need your money. I said this before. It's not about the rich Rothschilds or the rich or the evil. It's not even the evil bankers or the Illuminati or the New World Order or no. All those are puppets on strings. The state, as I say almost daily on this podcast, is the puppet master. The state doesn't need your money. The state is a mythical creature that exists in our minds. But in that existence, the state is almost all-powerful, because we believe in it so much. I was going to do a separate story on this, but I'm going to, and I may still, but first, let me just tease with something, or maybe not tease with it. This might be all I ever do on it. I've kicked around this idea for quite some time. There's an old movie from the mid-50s. Actually, from 1956, there's a movie called Forbidden Planet. And sci-fi fanatics will know exactly what I'm talking about the minute that I said that. But this movie, Forbidden Planet, is considered one of the breakthrough movies, especially in the science fiction genre. It's kind of a cult classic, yet at the same time, it was really cutting edge in a lot of different ways for science fiction movies. Had serious stars in it, not just, you know, in the 50s there were a lot of garbage science fiction movies produced. Forbidden Planet stands out. It's the one with that introduced Robbie the robot. You know, that later they ripped it off and used it in the Lost in Space series. But in the movie, it was released in 1956. Hopefully, I'm not spoiling it for anybody by giving out this the plot twists or any of the part that's in it. in the movie, there's this guy named Morbius, and Morbius lives on this planet, the Forbidden Planet, and he lives there with his daughter, and it's a long, drawn-out story. I'm not going to go into the whole movie, but the point is that there's this ancient race of people who used to live on this planet, and after, you know, long time, they perfected this machine, and this machine was going to supply for them all of their wants and needs. And kind of like in the Zeitgeist movies, kind of like what the Venus Project people, kind of like their fantasy dream is kind of portrayed the same way that that these people, this ancient race on this planet, had something like this magic machine that the Venus Project people hoped to somehow produce. So this giant machine, and it's a massive machine that takes up like a huge part of the interior of the planet, this machine could produce anything that they wanted, anything that they desired. The problem is, the movie itself, Forbidden Planet, goes into some Freudian, you know, during the 50s, it's like there came this moment, actually around the late 40s, 48 or 49 or so, when a lot of Hollywood writers and a lot of Hollywood big shots discovered the fun of psychoanalysis. They discovered Freudian psychiatry, and it was like from about 48 or 49 up through the 50s. You were nobody in Hollywood unless you were on the couch explaining all about your childhood. It was a big thing. So you see this pop up in quite a few movies because all of a sudden there were all these armchair, shrinks in Hollywood writing movies that thought they knew everything about psychiatry. So they would try to slip it into movies whenever possible. So part of the Forbidden Planet is this Freudian lesson that the Hollywood writers, that script writers are giving to us to have us understand some of these Freudian concepts. And one of the things is a psychic apparatus, a Freudian psychic apparatus called the id, I-D, the id. The id is kind of like that part in the back of your mind that's kind of hard to control. Freud said, let me look up here his actual quote. He said, contrary impulses exist side by side without canceling each other out. He's talking about within the id, within that part of your psyche, within that part of your mind. Contrary impulses exist side by side without canceling each other out. And he said, it is the dark, inaccessible part of our personality. What little we know of it, we have learned from our study of the dream work and of the construction of neurotic symptoms. And most of that is of a negative character and can be described only as a contrast to the ego. So like the id is like the evil side of your ego. It's out of control. It makes up its own thing. And according to Freud's belief, it's that part of your brain that's, you know, that gets control once you go to sleep, and it makes your dreams, and it twists all that weird stuff that happens in your dreams. Okay, so let's go back to Forbidden Planet. So in the movie The Forbidden Planet, this ancient race of really, really smart people developed this great, 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 great machine, and it's found in the interior of the planet because it's so big. It's like, I think he said it was something like 20 miles long and 20 miles deep and 20 miles wide or something like that. I can't remember exactly. But anyway, this guy Morbius that lives on the planet now... Oh, I forgot to say. So here's what happened. So this ancient race developed this machine. Then one night they all went to sleep. And in their sleep, their id and all of its weird and twisted desires activated this machine, and the machine created the product of all their collective dreams. In other words, they're all of them being asleep, their id part of their personality came out in their dreams through this machine, created a monster that killed them all in one night. So that's the disastrous story of these genius people that lived on this planet. And it might be a little something for the Venus Project folks to think about. Maybe go rent that movie, Forbidden Planet, pick it up at Netflix or whatever, and take a look at that old movie and just learn the lesson from it. But anyway, so in one night, everybody on the planet was killed by the monster of their own dreams that this machine had created for them. And then, of course, once they were dead, the monster evaporated and disappeared. It no longer existed because it only existed as a part of their dream world. So then years and years and years, thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. Actually, I think 200,000 years is the figure that's thrown out in the movie. 200,000 years goes by. And then Morbius and another party of people are space explorers, and they land on this planet. And over the course of a period of time, everybody is killed somehow except Morbius and his daughter. And so it's unclear exactly how these people all got killed and why Morbius and his daughter were not killed. And then a certain amount of time goes by, I think it's like 20 years or something, and more space travelers come to see what happened to the people who landed on that planet. And that's when the movie actually starts. We get the new people arrive to find out what's going on. Morbius tries to tell them, go away, go away. You'll all die if you stay here. And then we begin to understand that even at that point in time in the movie, this id monster still comes out at night. Except now it's the dream world, it's the dream id of Morbius. Morbius, when he goes to sleep, his mind interacts with this machine, and it creates an id monster that walks the surface of the planet. And so when the new arrived space travelers are there, and when Morbius finally falls asleep, his dream id goes out and tries to attack the spaceship and attack the new space travelers that have shown up, and he kills, you know, the monster kills some of them, and they put up a barrier and they shoot lasers at the monster, and all these things take place in the movie. But the point of the deal is that the evil monster is the id, is the side personality, the hidden personality, the dream personality of Morbius. So as soon as Morbius wakes up, the id monster disappears. Until in the end, and I won't get all into that, but anyway, so that's the idea, that this id monster, that the computer creates the dream world into reality, and so the monster of the bad part of your personality comes out in the form of this monster, and that's what goes and wreaks havoc. Now, that was a long way to go to get to what I'm about to say. But in a sense, when we, all humans worldwide, or when humans in one geographical area, all begin to believe that there is a state, when we all together collectively decide in our minds that the state is a real thing, then in a very real sense, it becomes that id monster like in the movie Forbidden Planet. Except it's not so obvious to see. You know, in Forbidden Planet, the monster was this big, partially invisible glob that went around and bashed on doors and picked up people by the ankle and things like this. The id monster that we deal with is the state. It exists in our minds. It exists so long as we allow it to exist. And the moment that we stop believing in it, it begins to evaporate. And when we all stop believing in it, it disappears altogether. Now, and I've talked about this before, that the beginning of the state, well, I've talked about it two different ways. The beginning of the state, as far as its physical manifestation on Earth, as far as we know, there may have been examples that the sands of history do not reveal at this point in time. But as far as we know, the first appearance of the state that left a permanent scar that we can go back and dig around it and look at it and pick things up and hold it and say, yes, here is evidence of the state. That first happened in Jericho. The very first state that we know of was a city-state that developed in Jericho, where a wall and a tower, where there's evidence of a wall and a tower, and a garrison. And it's clear to the honest observer that basically a group of thieves fortified themselves in a robber's roost on the mound of Jericho, and from there they could ride out and rob the countryside. And so that's the birth of the state on the physical side. But on that id monster side, on that imaginary side of the state, the actual existence of the state happened when human beings decided that we could ignore the laws of nature, the laws of our Creator, the laws that were handed to us through the natural process of whatever it took to put us here and make us what we are. When we chose to ignore those laws and make up laws, actually, not all of us are making up the laws. One small group of men, and I say men because it's almost always men. There are women in government as well. And there have been very large personality females that were in government. But essentially, when mankind takes it upon himself to make the laws and then inflict those upon other human beings, that act is the creation of the state. And maybe it didn't have its full metamorphosis to actually build cities and put rocks on top of each other and become what we call the state. Maybe it took some time for that to happen. I'm sure it did. But the state was birthed in the heart of men when man decided that rather than following the laws that he was born with, that his species is natural with, rather than following those laws that guide his species, mankind decided that he would let a small group of human beings make up law and enforce law. And man, all the rest of mankind, would bow their head and be obedient to those few. When that took place, we literally took human beings, a very small pocket of human beings, and put them in the position of lawgiver. We made gods of them. And as long as we hold them up, those lawgivers, as long as we hold them up in our imaginations, they become the state, and they are the id monster from Forbidden Planet. And it becomes a bodiless organism, a bodiless conscious that inflicts its will upon us. And so now let's take this back to taxes. It's not about how much taxes you pay. It's not about how much taxes the rich pay or how much the poor pay, or whether it's a flat level tax or whether it's a graduated income tax or whether it's a sales tax or whether it's a use tax. None of those things matter. What matters is that you are being robbed and you allow it. That's the key. The fact that you know that there's a gun pointed to your head, you allow the robbery, you are part and partial to the robbery, you even want to make sure that your neighbor is robbed a fair amount. You don't want to be robbed more than your neighbor. You want to make sure he gets robbed too. You see, all this mentality is based on jealousy. Why would you care what somebody else pays in their taxes? Why would you care if they, quote, pay their fair share? Not your business. You're getting robbed. You should only notice whether or not you're getting robbed. You should only notice the gun pointed at your forehead and the robber telling you that you have to pay. That's your business, and that's what you need to recognize. And once we all begin to see the robber for what he is, then we can begin to deal with him. It doesn't matter if some rich person is getting robbed to their proportion or some poor person is getting robbed to their proportion. What matters is that we're being robbed. And we allow it. And we keep our head down. And we keep working. We keep going. We maintain our slave position. As long as we're doing that, we're perpetuating the state. We're keeping that id monster alive. But the minute we open our eyes and wake up, just like Morbius wakes up and the id monster disappears, the moment all of us together wake up and pick our heads up and realize that this is just a dream, then the state vanishes, just like that. Okay, so then somebody would say, well, let's get this on practical terms. Without these taxes, how would government support itself? How would these things get done? And then there's this laundry list of stuff. Emergency services. How would we know that there's no razor blades in our apples? How would we know that food is safe? How would we know that medicines are safe? Okay, well, in the past, all these things were not the job of government. These are excuses that the government has created to distract you from the fact that you've got your head down and your shoulder against the wheel. It's all of that noise is made to distract you, to make you think, oh, I can't live without the state. I can't live without this service. I can't live without that service. How would this happen without the state? How would that happen without the state? All of that is the noise of the whip cracking over your head to keep you down, to keep you looking down, to keep you from actually realizing what's going on and waking up and opening your eyes. How would these services be paid for? Well, if there's a market for a service, then there's a way for that service to be paid for. So let's take food safety, for example. Now, currently, for you to be able to grow crops and say that they are organic, the government owns the word organic. I would assume all my listeners know this already, but in case you don't, the government actually owns the word organic. I can't go in my backyard. I'm not allowed to, by law, go into my backyard and grow, let's say, cabbages. And if I put all of the techniques that I have learned to grow cabbages with no chemicals of any kind, I don't spray anything on it to kill bugs, I don't fertilize it with anything weird, I go back there and I make sure that the cabbages are grown 100% naturally without any artificial influence upon them at all, I cannot then take that cabbage and sell it as organic, because the government owns the word organic and the government decides what is and what isn't organic. And if I, and for me to sell my cabbage as organic, I have to pay money to the government, I have to fill out the paperwork, I have all these things I have to do in order to use the word organic with my cabbage. Okay, now, is that worth it? Well, you go to the grocery store and there's a row of things there that are called organic, and people pay extra money to have that organic certification on there, you see? The difference is the government has a monopoly on that word. And when the government gives us inspections and gives us a promise of a quality promise of a particular product, it's worth, let's see, there's something else in my backyard that has a worth, has a value about the same as the word of the government. I have two large dogs. Well, I have one large dog and one medium dog, and I have a small dog inside the house. And therefore, in my backyard, separate from my garden, by the way, I have separate fencing back there, but the bulk of my backyard, my dogs run free in that yard. And they have a tendency to leave little piles all around the yard. I call them landmines. But we know what they really are. Now, the word of the government is about the same value as one of those little landmines out there in my backyard, one of those little doggy landmines. That's about how good the word of the government is. Think about this for a minute. Think for yourself about how many times, and this has happened across Europe and it's happened across North America, you think about how many times in the last couple of years word has gone out, oh no, salmonella poisoning in, not poisoning, but it's a, infection. Salmonella outbreak, it's coming from spinach, it's coming from broccoli, it's coming from cantaloupe, it's coming from cucumbers. How can that be? How can that be when the government is supposedly inspecting and authorizing and clarifying and doing all the stuff it has to do? How is it that these things still come through? The reason why is because it's an impossible task for the government to make sure that every piece of food is perfectly clean. Then why do we pay the government to say that it's doing that? Why do we lie to ourselves and convince ourselves that the government is doing this when it's an impossible task? Wouldn't it be better if a particular company, let's say you buy your cucumbers from Bob's Wholesale Cucumbers, if you're buying your cucumbers from Bob's Wholesale Cucumbers and Bob guarantees his cucumbers are illness free, then if you eat his cucumbers and you get sick, you have Bob to point the finger at, not a vague government agency, not a vast confusing layers and layers and layers of where did this come from. Bob certified it, and if Bob certified it, his word's on it, and he can be held responsible. And if Bob's not willing to certify it, oh, maybe you won't eat it. You see, that's when certification actually starts to have a value. A different example would be police. And people are always worried about, well, what would the police would knock down your door. No, I'm sorry. They do that now. The robbers would knock down your door if the police weren't here. Well, no. As I say all the time, when seconds count, police are 8 to 12 minutes away. Police don't keep the robbers from knocking down your door. Police show up afterwards and fill out paperwork if you're alive. If not, they take pictures of the body. That's what the police do. The police do not keep you safe. The police shuffle papers after the fact. So, what would real police be like? Well, we've had this at times in history. I'm not proposing something that's never been done before. Private security agencies have existed throughout history, and they work. We don't need government police. Private security can produce the same product at a much better price. And they can do it while serving the customer rather than beating the customer. And this goes for every other thing. What about foreign aggressors? Well, what about foreign aggressors? What about foreign aggressors? How many people are trying to invade Switzerland? How many people are trying to invade Hong Kong? How many people are trying to invade Australia? Now, Australia does help out with several of the United States' imperial projects, shall we say. But mostly, Australia minds its own business. The amount of interference that Australia has had, specifically in the Muslim world in the Middle East, has caused some anger against Australia, and Australian people have suffered some attacks because of that, and that's very unfortunate. But that's happened specifically because the Australian government has chosen to be on the side of the government in Washington, D.C., as they poke and prod these small, little, weak countries throughout the Middle East. And so there's been some repercussions to that. You see, the government in Washington, D.C. has to have an evil enemy to justify itself. And if they don't have an evil enemy, they make one, because they have to justify themselves. They have to keep us all afraid constantly, constantly in fear that, oh, the terrorists are going to come and get us. Oh, these guys are going to invade us. The Russians are going to get us. The Chinese are going to get us. The North Koreans are going to get us. The Iranians are going to get us. They have to constantly be throwing fear at us in order to keep our head down. If the state were not there agitating country against country constantly, then the people in Uzbekistan or the people in Iran or the people in Cambodia or the people in any other country wouldn't care what you do in Memphis, wouldn't care what you do in Montreal, wouldn't care what you do in San Diego. They wouldn't care. Why would they care? Why would the people in Afghanistan care what life is like in Seattle? Why would they care? They don't care. They only care when we send people over there and we mess with their leaders and we mess with their government and we pump money into one leader as opposed to another. That's when they care. And we've been doing that for 100 years. 100 years. We have the U.S. government, not us, me, no, not we. I'm wrong when I say that. Not we. The U.S. government, based in Washington, D.C., has continually and consistently messed with those people's governments for 100 years. How could you expect them not to respond? That's what the government does for you. That's what the state does for you. The state agitates someone and makes an enemy out of them. While you sleep and dream of the state goes out and manipulates other people. And it's doing the same thing with them, too. The state's playing the same game with them, making them fearful of you. There are people sitting in the Middle East saying, why do Americans want to attack us? Why do Americans want to drop bombs on us? Why do these people do this? They're afraid of you, just like you're afraid of them. And it's because that evil state, that evil part of your mind, that id, that is the state, that Morpheus's monster, is out there doing these things. And what do we do about it? Wake up, Morbius. Wake up. See the gun. See the robbery. Realize what's taking place. Don't be conned into this game. Oh, well, if we just have a flat tax, everything's going to be okay. We'll all be taxed equally. Mr. Robber, rob that guy. He's got money in his boot. Don't let him get away with that. Rob that guy. Wake up, Morbius. Wake up.